The big glass beaker for the cure had been placed on a pedestal in the middle of the floor. The wizards liked to make a ceremony of everything in any case, but felt instinctively that if they were going to cure the biggest hangover in the world, it needed to be done with style. Susan and Bilious watched as the ingredients were added. Round about halfway, the mixture, which was an orange-brown colour, went gloop.
Not a lot of improvement, I feel, said the lecturer in recent runes.
Engelbert's enhancer was the penultimate ingredient. The dean dropped in a greenish ball of light that sank under the surface. The only apparent effect was that it caused purple bubbles to creep over the sides of the beaker and drip onto the floor.
That's it, said the Ogod.
I think the yoghurt probably wasn't a good idea, said the dean.
I'm not drinking that,
said Bilious firmly, and then clutched at his head.
But gods are practically unkillable, aren't they?
Said the dean.
Oh, good, muttered Bilious. Why not stick my legs in a meat grinder, then?
Well, if you think it might help.
I anticipated a certain amount of resistance from the patient, said the Arch-Chancellor. He removed his hat and fished out a small crystal ball from a pocket in the lining. Let's see what the god of wine is up to at the moment, shall we? Shouldn't be too difficult to locate a fun-loving god like him on an evening like this. He blew on the glass and polished it. Then he brightened up. Why, here he is, the little rascal. On Dun Manifestin, I do believe. Yes, yes, reclining on his couch surrounded by naked maenads.
What?
Maniacs, said the dean. He means excitable young women, said Susan. And it seemed to her that there was a general ripple of movement among the wizards, a sort of nonchalant drawing towards the glittering ball.
Can't quite see what he's doing, said Ridcully.
Let me see if I can make it out, said the Chair of Indefinite Studies hopefully.
Ridcully half turned to keep the ball out of his reach.
Ah, yes, he said. It looks like he's drinking. Yes, could very well be a lager and black currant, if I'm any judge.
Oh, me,
moaned the Ogod.
These young women now, the lecturer in recent runes began.
I can see there's some bottles on the table, Ridcully continued. That one, yes, could be scumble, which, as you know, is made from apples.
Mainly apples, the dean volunteered. Now, about these poor mad girls,
the Ogod slumped to his knees.
And there's that drink, you know, there's a worm in the bottle. Oh, me. And there's an empty glass, a big one, can't quite see what it contained, but there's a paper umbrella in it, and some cherries on a stick. Oh, and an amusing little monkey.
Oh.
Of course, there's a lot of other bottles too, said Ridcully cheerfully. Different coloured drinks, mainly. The sort made from melons and coconuts and chocolate and such like. Don't you know? Funny thing is, all the glasses on the table are pint mugs.
Bilious fell forward.
All right, he murmured. I'll drink the wretched stuff.
Not quite ready yet, said Ridcully.
Ah, thank you, Modo.
Modo tiptoed in, pushing a trolley. There was a large metal bowl on it, in which a small bottle stood in the middle of a heap of crushed ice.
Only just made this for Hogswatch dinner, said Ridcully. Hasn't had much time to mature yet.
He put down the crystal and fished a pair of heavy gloves out of his hat. The wizards spread like an opening flower. One moment they were gathered around Ridcully, the next they were standing close to various items of heavy furniture. Susan felt she was present at a ceremony and hadn't been told the rules.
What's that? She said as Ridcully carefully lifted up the bottle. Wow, wow, sauce, said Ridcully. Finest condiment known to man. A happy accompaniment to meat, fish, fowl, eggs, and many types of vegetable dishes. It's not safe to drink it when sweat's still condensing on the bottle, though.
He peered at the bottle and then rubbed at it, causing a glassy, squeaky noise.
On the other hand, he said brightly, if it's a kill-or-cure remedy, then we are, given that the patient is practically immortal, probably on to a winner.
He placed a thumb over the cork and shook the bottle vigorously. There was a crash as the Chair of Indefinite Studies and the Senior Wrangler tried to get under the same table.
And these fellows seem to have taken against it for some reason, he said, approaching the beaker. I prefer a sauce that doesn't mean you mustn't make any jolting movements for half an hour after using it, muttered the dean.
And that can't be used for breaking up small rocks, said the senior wrangler.
Or getting rid of tree roots, said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"And which isn't exactly outlawed in three cities," said the lecturer in recent runes.
Ridcully cautiously uncorked the bottle. There was a brief hiss of indrawn air. He allowed a few drops to splash into the beaker. Nothing happened. A more generous helping was allowed to fall. The mixture remained irredeemably inert. Ridcully sniffed suspiciously at the bottle. "I wonder if I added enough grated wahuni," he said, and then upturned the sauce and let most of it slide into the mixture. It merely went gloop. The wizards began to stand up and brush themselves off, giving one another the rather embarrassed grins of people who know that they've just been part of a synchronized making-a-fool-of-yourself team.
"I know we've had that as a fetida rather a long time," said Ridcully.
He turned the bottle round, peering at it sadly. Finally, he tipped it up for the last time and thumped it hard on the base. A trickle of sauce arrived on the lip of the bottle and glistened there for a moment. Then it began to form a bead. As if drawn by invisible strings, the heads of the wizards turned to look at it. Wizards wouldn't be wizards if they couldn't see a little way into the future. As the bead swelled and started to go pear-shaped, they turned, and with a surprising turn of speed for men so wealthy in years and waistline, began to dive for the floor. The drop fell. It went gloop. And that was all. Ridcully, who'd been standing like a statue, sagged in relief.
"I don't know," he said, turning away. "I wish you fellows would show some backbone."
The fireball lifted him off his feet. Then it rose to the ceiling, where it spread out widely and vanished with a pop, leaving a perfect chrysanthemum of scorched plaster. Pure white light filled the room, and there was a sound. Tinkle, tinkle, fizz. The wizards risked looking round. The beaker gleamed. It was filled with a liquid glow which bubbled gently and sent out sparkles like a spinning diamond.
"My word," breathed the lecturer in recent runes.
Ridcully picked himself up off the floor. Wizards tended to roll well, or in any case are well padded enough to bounce. Slowly, the flickering brilliance casting their long shadows on the walls, the wizards gravitated towards the beaker.
"Well, what is it?" said the dean.
"I remember my father telling me some very valuable advice about drinks," said Ridcully. "He said, 'Son, never drink any drink with a paper umbrella in it, never drink any drink with a humorous name, and never drink any drink that changes colour when the last ingredient goes in. And never, ever do this.'" He dipped his finger into the beaker.
It came out with one glistening drop on the end.
"Careful, Arch-Chancellor," warned the Dean. "What you have there might represent pure sobriety."
Ridcully paused with the finger halfway to his lips.
"Good point," he said. "I don't want to start being sober at my time of life."
He looked around.
"How do we usually test stuff?"
"Generally, we ask for student volunteers," said the Dean.
"What happens if we don't get any?"
"We give it to them anyway."
"Isn't that a bit unethical?"
"Not if we don't tell them, Arch-Chancellor."
"Ah, good point." "I'll try it," the O-God mumbled.
"Something these clown gentlemen have cooked up," said Susan. "It might kill you."
"You've never had a hangover, I expect," said the O-God. "Otherwise you wouldn't talk such rot."
He staggered up to the beaker, managed to grip it on the second go, and drank the lot.
There'll be fireworks now," said the Raven from Susan's shoulder. "Flames coming out of the mouth. Screams clutching at the throat, lying down under the cold tap, that sort of thing."
Death found, to his amazement, that dealing with the queue was very enjoyable. Hardly anyone had ever been pleased to see him before.
"Next! And what's your name, little—"
He hesitated, but rallied and continued.
"Person?"
"Nobby Nobbs, Hogfather," said Nobby.
Was it him, or was this knee he was sitting on a lot bonier than it should be? His buttocks argued with his brain, and were sat on.
"And have you been a good boar, a good dwarf, a good a good individual?"
And suddenly Nobby found he had no control at all of his tongue. Of its own accord, gripped by a terrible compulsion, it said,
"Yes."
He struggled for self-possession as the great voice went on.
"So I expect you'll want a present for a good monster, good human, a good male."
Aha, got you, bang to rights. You'll be coming along with me, my old chummy. I bet you don't remember the cellar at the back of the shoelace makers in Old Cobblers, eh? All those hogswatch mornings with a little hole in my world, eh? The words rose in Nobby's throat, but were overridden by something ancient before they reached his voice box, and to his amazement were translated into...
Yes.
Something nice.
Yes.
There was hardly anything left of Nobby's conscious will now. The world consisted of nothing but his naked soul and the Hogfather who filled the universe.
And you will, of course, be good for another year.
The tiny remnant of basic Nobbiness wanted to say,
how exactly do you define good, mister? Like, suppose there was just some stuff that no one had missed, say? Or, for instance, say a friend of mine was on patrol, sort of thing, and found a shopkeeper had left his door unlocked at night. I mean, anyone could walk in, right? But suppose this friend took one or two things, sort of like, you know, a gratuity, and then called the shopkeeper out and got him to lock up. That counts as good, does it?
Good and bad were, to Nobby's way of thinking, entirely relative terms. Most of his relatives, for example, were criminals. But again, this invitation to philosophical debate was ambushed somewhere in his head by sheer dread of the big beard in the sky.
Yes,
he squeaked.
Now, I wonder what you would like.
Nobby gave up and sat mute. Whatever was going to happen next was going to happen, and there was not a thing he could do about it. Right now, the light at the end of his mental tunnel showed only more tunnel.
Ah, yes.
The Hogfather reached into his sack and pulled out an awkwardly shaped present wrapped in festive hogswatch paper, which, owing to some slight confusion on the current Hogfather's part, had merry ravens on it. Corporal Nobbs took it in nervous hands.
What do you say?
Thank you.
Off you go.
Corporal Nobbs slid down, gratefully, and barged his way through the crowds, stopping only when he was fielded by Constable Visit.
What happened? What happened? I couldn't see.
I dunno, mumbled Nobby.
He gave me this. What is it?
I dunno. He clawed at the raven-bedecked paper.
This is disgusting, this whole business, said Constable Visit. It's the worship of idols. It's a genuine burly and strong-in-the-arm double-action triple cantilever crossbow with a polished walnut stock and engraved silver facings. A crass commercialisation of a date which is purely of astronomical significance, said Visit, who seldom paid attention when he was in mid-denounce. If it is to be celebrated at all, then... I saw this in Bows and Ammo. It's got editor's choice in the What to Buy When Rich Uncle Sidney Dies category. They had to break both the reviewer's arms to get him to let go of it. Ought to be commemorated in a small service of... It costs more than a year's salary. They only make them to order. You have to wait ages. Religious significance.
It dawned on Constable Visit that something behind him was amiss.
"Aren't we going to arrest this impostor, Corporal?"
he said. Corporal Nobbs looked blearily at him through the mists of possessive pride.
"You're foreign, washpot," he said. "I can't expect you to know the real meaning of Ogswatch."
The Ogod blinked.
"Ugh," he said. "That's better. Oh, yes. Oh, that's a lot better, thank you."
The wizards who shared the raven's belief in the essential narrative conventions of life watched him cautiously.
"Any minute now," said the lecturer in recent runes confidently, "it'll probably start with some kind of amusing yell." "You know," said the Ogod, "I think I could just possibly eat a soft-boiled egg. Or maybe the ears spinning round.
And perhaps drink a glass of milk," said the Ogod. Ridcully looked nonplussed.
"You really feel better?" he said.
"Oh, yes," said the Ogod. "I really think I could risk a smile without the top of my head falling off."
"No, no, no," said the Dean. "This can't be right. Everyone knows that a good hangover cure has to involve a lot of humorous shouting, etc."
"I could possibly tell you a joke," said the Ogod carefully.
"You don't have this pressing urge to run outside and stick your head in a water butt," said Ridcully.
"Not really," said the Ogod, "but I'd like some toast, if that helps."
The Dean took off his hat and pulled a thaumameter out of the point. Something happened, he said. There was a massive thalamic surge. Didn't it even taste a bit, well, spicy, said Red Cully.
It didn't taste of anything, really, said the O-God.
Oh, look, it's obvious, said Susan. When the god of wine drinks, Bilious here gets the after effects. So when the god of hangovers drinks a hangover cure, then the effects must jump back across the same link. That could be right, said the Dean. He is, after all, basically a conduit.
I've always thought of myself as more of a tube, said the O-God.
No, no, she's right, said Ridcully. When he drinks, this lad here gets the nasty result. So logically, when our friend here takes a hangover cure, the side effects should head back the same way.
Someone mentioned a crystal ball just now, said the O-God in a voice suddenly clanging with vengeance. I want to see this.
It was a big drink. A very big and a very long drink. It was one of those special cocktails where each very sticky, very strong ingredient is poured in very slowly so that they layer on top of one another. Drinks like this tend to get called traffic lights or rainbow's revenge or, in places where truth is more highly valued, hello and goodbye, Mr. Brain Cell. In addition, this drink had some lettuce floating in it and a slice of lemon and a piece of pineapple hooked coquettishly on the side of the glass, which had sugar frosted round the rim. There were two paper umbrellas, one pink and one blue, and they each had a cherry on the end. And someone had taken the trouble to freeze ice cubes in the shape of little elephants. After that, there's no hope. You might as well be drinking in a place called the Coco Cabana. The god of wine picked it up lovingly. It was his kind of drink. There was a rumba going on in the background. There were also a couple of young ladies snuggling up to him. It was going to be a good night. It was always a good night.
"Happy Hogswatch, everyone," he said and raised the glass. And then, "Can anyone hear something?"
Something blew a paper squeaker at him.
"No, seriously, like a sort of descending note."
Since no one paid this any attention, he shrugged and nudged one of his fellow drinkers.
"How about we have a couple more and go to this club I know?" he said. And then...
The wizards leaned back, and one or two of them grimaced. Only the O-God stayed glued to the glass, face contorted in a vicious smile.
"We have eructation!" he shouted, and punched the air. "Yes, yes, yes! The worm is on the other boot now, eh? How do you like them apples?"
"Well, mainly apples," said the Dean. "Look like a lot of other things to me," said Ridcully. "It seems we have reversed the cause-effect flow."
"Will it be permanent?" said the O-God, hopefully.
"I shouldn't think so. After all, you are the god of hangovers. It'll probably just reverse itself again when the potion wears off."
"Then I may not have much time. Bring me, 20 pints of lager, some pepper vodka and a bottle of coffee liqueur with an umbrella in it. Let's see how he enjoys that, Mr. You've Got Room for Another One in There."
Susan grabbed his hand and pulled him over to a bench. "I didn't have you sobered up just so you could go on a binge," she said. He blinked at her.
"You didn't?"
"I want you to help me."
"Help you what?"
"You said you'd never been human before, didn't you?" The O-God looked down at himself.
"That's right," he said. "Never."
"You've never incarnated?" said Ridcully.
"Surely that's a rather personal question, isn't it?" said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"That's right," said the O-God. "Odd that. I remember always having headaches, but never having a head. That can't be right, can it?"
"You existed in potentia," said Ridcully.
"Did I?"
"Did he?" said Susan. Ridcully paused.
"Oh, dear," he said. "I think I did it, didn't I? I said something to young Stibbons about drinking and hangovers, didn't I?"
"And you created him just like that," said the Dean.
"I find that very hard to believe, Mustrum. Out of thin air. I suppose we can all do that, can we? Anyone care to think up some new pixie?"
"Like the hair loss fairy," said the lecturer in recent runes.
The other wizards laughed.
"I am not losing my hair," snapped the Dean. "It is just very finely spaced."
"Half on your head and half on your hairbrush," said the lecturer in recent runes.
"No sense in being bashful about going bald," said Ridcully evenly. "Anyway, you know what they say about bald men, Dean."
"Yes, they say, 'Look at him, he's got no hair,'" said the lecturer in recent runes.
The Dean had been annoying him lately. "For the last time," shouted the Dean, "I am not..." He stopped. There was a glinga-linga-linga-linga-linga-linga noise. "I wish I knew where that was coming from," said Ridcully. The Dean began. "Is there something on my head?" The other wizards stared. Something was moving under his hat. Very carefully, he reached up and removed it. The very small gnome sitting on his head had a clump of the Dean's hair in each hand. It blinked guiltily in the light.
Is there a problem?" it said.
"Get it off me!" the Dean yelled.
The wizards hesitated. They were all vaguely aware of the theory that very small creatures could pass on diseases, and while the gnome was larger than such creatures were generally thought to be, no one wanted to catch expanding scalp sickness. Susan grabbed it. "Are you the hair loss fairy?" she said.
Apparently, said the gnome, wriggling in her grip.
The Dean ran his hands desperately through his hair.
"What have you been doing with my hair?" he demanded.
"Well, some of it I think I have to put on hair brushes," said the gnome. "But sometimes I think I weave it into little mats to block up the bath with."
"What do you mean, you think?" said Ridcully.
"Just a minute," said Susan. She turned to the Ogod. "Where exactly were you before I found you in the snow?"
Everywhere, I think," said the Ogod. "Anywhere where drink has been consumed in beastly quantities some time previously, you could say."
"Aha!" said Ridcully. "You were an immanent vital force, yes?"
"I suppose I could have been," the Ogod conceded.
"And when we joked about the hair loss fairy, it suddenly focused on the Dean's head," said Ridcully, "where its operations have been noticeable to all of us in recent months, although, of course, we have been far too polite to pass comment on the subject."
"You're calling things into being," said Susan.
"Things like the give the Dean a huge bag of money goblin," said the Dean, who could think very quickly at times. He looked around hopefully. "Anyone hear any fairy tinkling?"
"Do you often get given huge bags of money, sir?" said Susan.
"Not on what you'd call a daily basis, no," said the Dean. "But if,
"Then there probably isn't any occult room for a huge bags of money goblin," said Susan.
"I personally have always wondered what happens to my socks," said the bursar cheerfully. "You know how there's always one missing. When I was a lad, I always thought that something was taking them."
The wizards gave this some thought. Then they all heard it, the little crinkly, tinkling noise of magic taking place. The Arch-Chancellor pointed dramatically skywards.
"To the laundry," he said.
"It's downstairs, Ridcully," said the Dean.
"Down to the laundry."
"And you know Mrs. Whitlow doesn't like us going in there," said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"And who is Arch-Chancellor of this university, may I ask?" said Ridcully. "Is it Mrs. Whitlow? I don't think so. Is it me? Why, how amazing. I do believe it is."
"Yes, but you know what she can be like," said the Chair.
Yes, that's true," Ridcully began.
"I believe she's gone to her sister's for the holiday," said the bursar.
"We certainly don't have to take orders from any kind of housekeeper," said the Arch-Chancellor.
"To the laundry!"
The wizards surged out excitedly, leaving Susan, the Ogod, the Veruca Gnome, and the Hair Loss Fairy.
"Tell me again who those people were," said the Ogod.
"Some of the cleverest men in the world," said Susan.
"And I'm sober, am I?"
"Clever isn't the same as sensible," said Susan. "And they do say that if you wish to walk the path to wisdom, then for your first step, you must become as a small child."
"Do you think they've heard about the second step?"
Susan sighed. "Probably not, but sometimes they fall over it while they're running around shouting."
"Ah,"
the Ogod looked around.
"Do you think they have any soft drinks here?" he said.
The path to wisdom does in fact begin with a single step. Where people go wrong is in ignoring all the thousands of other steps that come after it. They make the single step of deciding to become one with the universe, and for some reason forget to take the logical next step of living for 70 years on a mountain and a daily bowl of rice and yak butter tea that would give it any kind of meaning. While evidence says that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, they're probably all on first steps. The Dean was always at his best at times like this. He led the way between the huge ancient copper vats, prodding with his staff into dark corners and going, "Hut, hut," under his breath.
"Why would it turn up here?" whispered the lecturer in recent runes.
"Point of reality instability," said Ridcully, standing on tiptoe to look into a bleaching cauldron. "Every damn thing turns up here. You should know that by now."
"But why now?" said the Chair of Indefinite Studies.
"No talking," hissed the Dean, and leapt out into the next alleyway, staff held protectively in front of him. "Ha!" he screamed, and then looked disappointed.
How big would this sock-stealing thing be?" said the senior wrangler.
"Don't know," said Ridcully. He peered behind a stack of washboards. "Come to think of it, I must have lost a ton of socks over the years."
"Me too," said the lecturer in recent runes.
"So should we be looking in small places or very large places?"
the senior wrangler went on, in the voice of one whose train of thought has just entered a long, dark tunnel.
"Good point," said Ridcully. "Dean, why do you keep referring to sheds all the time?"
"It's hut, Mustrum," said the Dean. It means...
"Small wooden building?" Ridcully suggested.
"Well, sometimes, agreed, but other times, well, you just have to say hut."
"This sock creature, does it just steal them or does it eat them?" said the senior wrangler.
"Valuable contribution, that man," said Ridcully, giving up on the Dean. "Right, pass the word along. No one is to look like a sock. Understand?"
"How can you..." the Dean began and stopped. They all heard it. It was a busy sound, the sound of something with a serious appetite to satisfy.
"The eater of socks," moaned the senior wrangler with his eyes shut.
"How many tentacles would you expect it to have?" said the lecturer in recent runes. "I mean, roughly speaking."
"It's a very large sort of noise, isn't it?" said the bursar.
"To the nearest dozen, say," said the lecturer in recent runes, edging backwards.
"It'd probably tear our socks off as soon as look at us," wailed the senior wrangler.
"Ah, so at least 5 or 6 tentacles then, would you say?" said the lecturer in recent runes. "Seems to me it's coming from one of the washing engines," said the Dean.
The engines were each 2 stories high, and usually only used when the university's population soared during term time. A huge treadmill connected to a couple of big bleached wooden paddles in each vat, which were heated via the fireboxes underneath. In full production, the washing engines needed at least 6 people to manhandle the loads, maintain the fires, and oil the scrubbing arms. Ridcully had seen them at work once when it had looked like a picture of a very clean and hygienic hell, the kind of place soap might go to when it died. The Dean stopped by the door to the boiler area.
"Something's in here," he whispered. "Listen." "It's stopped. It knows we're here," he hissed. "All right. Ready? Hut!"
"No," squeaked the lecturer in recent runes.
"I'll open the door and you'll be ready to stop it. 1, 2, 3.
Oh.